The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
When I sat down here, I felt kind of happy about the rain. Maybe you guys are happy too, right? I remember when I was young, I grew up here in the Bay Area, like, oh, it's raining. But now it's like, oh, yay, it's raining. It's nice. It made me happy here. So a big part of Buddhist practice, kind of an underlying foundation, which we often don't talk about explicitly, but is there, is this idea of making distinctions. Often very simple binary distinctions. This is skillful, this is unskillful. This is beneficial, unbeneficial. We're being mindful, we're not being mindful. This leads to greater suffering, this does not lead to greater suffering. Right? There's this real emphasis on making a distinction. And then after making that distinction, choosing what we want to do after that. But there's also kind of a type of not making distinctions. When we're mindful, we're mindful. It doesn't matter if we're mindful of our breath, if we're mindful of the sounds in the room, if we're mindful of the pain in our knee, it's still mindfulness. And that's something that is beneficial and can be cultivated. And the same idea, there's stress or suffering. In some ways, it doesn't matter what causes it. There's a certain element that's consistent about this idea of stress and suffering. There's different magnitudes, but there's also something that's common about it. So this idea of kind of lumping together things that are similar and splitting apart certain things. And back in the mid-19th century, when biologists were trying to categorize all organisms, you know, all birds, all reptiles, mammals, insects. They were assigning them genuses and species, you know, putting all these Latin names on them. And Charles Darwin made an observation. He was classifying the biologists who were classifying the organisms. And he was saying there are two types of people. Or biologists in this case, the lumpers and the splitters. There's people, maybe in today, we kind of talk about people who are introverted or extroverted. It doesn't mean that you are only introverted and never speak out loud. And if you're an extroverted person, you never are quiet. But people tend to have an inclination one way or the other. In the same way, there's lumpers and splitters. That is, individuals, when they find something new, they will sometimes, they will organize it or understand it by focusing on how is it similar to other things that they know? How is it like what they're more familiar with? Those are the lumpers. And then the splitters, when they encounter something new, it's like, how is it different? Well, how is this thing unique? What is special about this? And of course, just like introversion, extroversion, there isn't a right way. It's just the way that some of us are. Some of the way in which we make sense of our experiences, organize the world, and view things. But of course, we go from one to the other. And maybe just like with introversion and extroversion, it's only really a problem or an issue if we're at the either real extreme. Anywhere in between is fine. So in the same way with this Buddhist practice, it can be really helpful to do both some splitting and some lumping. When is it helpful to really tease things apart and look at how they're different? And when is it helpful to put things together and kind of see that they're the same? And an example of this is a teaching in the Middle Length Discourses called Two Kinds of Thought. Already by the title, we can tell that there's a certain amount of splitting that goes on here, right? Two kinds. And in this discourse, the Buddha is talking to his monks, and he's telling a story about before he was enlightened. Before, like, you know, this is something that he discovered and that he wants to share with his monks to help them on their path to awakening, just, you know, something that he discovered on his own path to awakening. And he says, while I was still an unenlightened bodhisattva, that's kind of what we call the Buddha before he was awakened, it occurred to me, suppose I divide my thoughts into two classes. I will set to one side thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, thoughts of cruelty. And I will set on the other side thoughts of renunciation, non-ill will, non-cruelty. So he had this idea. He was going to divide his thoughts in this way. And then he describes that when he went to meditate, a thought of ill will would arise. And I would see it clearly. Right? When we're meditating, often we can see like things with a clarity that we can't see when we're not meditating. I saw it clearly, and I understood. This thought of ill will leads to my affliction, leads to others' affliction, leads to the affliction of both myself and others. It obstructs wisdom. It causes difficulties. It leads away from awakening. So having understood these things about this thought that arose when he was meditating, he then considered, so doing a little bit more than just understanding, he kind of did a little bit of reflection on it. When I considered, this leads to my own affliction, this thought subsided. When I considered, this thought of ill will leads to others' afflictions, the thought subsided. When he considered, this thought of ill will leads to affliction of both myself and others, it subsided. So whenever a thought of ill will arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, and did away with it. So in this little excerpt from the sutta, we can see that, of course, he's doing some splitting, right? There's thoughts that lead to affliction, obstruct wisdom, are difficult and don't lead to awakening, and thoughts that don't. But he lumped together whether something was afflictive for himself, for others, or for both. It was just affliction was affliction. It doesn't matter whether it was troublesome for himself or was going to be troublesome for others. Those were something that was to be abandoned, to put down. For me, when I'm reading this, I feel a little bit... I don't know, I have this thought that arises to me, like, yeah, well, okay, that was easy for him to do. Like to, you know, just, it subsided, to put it down, to abandon these thoughts of ill will. It's not so easy, I think, for all of us, right, when we have thoughts to just make them go away once we understand them or consider them. So I would like to explore whether we could put this idea of things to lump together and things to split as a way to help us abandon or put down or otherwise not cultivate those types of thoughts that aren't helpful, that cause affliction, that obstruct wisdom, are uncomfortable. So one way that we can do this is we could examine how is it that we use lumping and splitting. And one obvious way is that we tend to separate us from them. Whatever the us happens to be and whatever the them happens to be. Instead of looking at what we share, lumping us together as humans, there tends to be a division between those that are like us or those that have the same ideas of us, or however we choose to kind of put people that are us and them. And this type of thinking tends to lead to discord, tends to lead to affliction, a certain type of distress or stress or pain or suffering. So I don't want to say that we're all exactly the same, because we're not. We're not all exactly the same. We all have our unique characteristics. We all have our unique stories, our cultural backgrounds. And I think that that's, we should celebrate them, recognize them, acknowledge them. But that doesn't mean that we have to separate people or lump them into two things, us and them. Instead, let's be very thorough in our lumping and just lump everybody together in a certain way, right? That there doesn't have to be a distinction that causes problems, that leads to suffering for ourselves or for others. Instead, we can recognize as human beings, there are things that we all share. As human beings, there are things that are, that we all share. And some of this, of course, is this wish to be free from suffering. This wish to find happiness. This wish to have a certain amount of ease in our lives. So one way to help us, or to support us, or to create the conditions in which we were less likely to kind of lump people into us and them, or maybe I should say split people between us and them, is to also not split people, split our experience so much between me and you. Of course, I'm different than you, right? I want to kind of recognize there's things that are unique to me, my story, that are different than your story and your experiences, your thoughts. But there's also things that we share. And we can look at what is it that we share and use that as a way to kind of support us so that we don't have to get into the us and them thinking, which then leads to suffering. So then in order to do that, we can look at what really creates the conditions in which I'm really focused on me and not so focused on you. I'm kind of, you know, focused on what's unique about me or what's kind of really highlights this idea about me. And of course, one of these things is our suffering. Sometimes when we are in pain, when we are in distress, when we are uncomfortable, when we have affliction, it often can be isolating. It can be a feeling like, oh, this is, we don't feel like we have the emotional energy or the wherewithal or the capacity to be caring about others or thinking about others when we are in the midst of our own suffering, when we are experiencing all the troubles that human beings experience. So then maybe one way to help us work with not getting into me and you, which then leads to us and them, which then leads into a certain type of affliction, is to work with our suffering. And this, of course, is where mindfulness can help us. It's part of why we do this mindfulness practice. It's just for this very reason. And so we can maybe do a little bit of splitting here. So now we've been doing it like kind of some of this lumping. So mindfulness practice can help us to tease apart those different aspects of our suffering, our distress, our stress, our pain, our uncomfortableness. And one way that is really helpful in my experience, and that's talked about a lot in the suttas and the discourses, is this idea of kind of separating, okay, if I, for example, have physical pain, there's, we could separate it, tease it apart. There's an element that's in my body. I have sensations in my body, whether it's a throbbing, a tingling, a knife being stabbed feeling, or heat feeling, or any of those things. There's sensations of clearly associated with the body, with pain. But there's also things in the mind that go with that pain. It can be maybe a fear of unknown. What is this? Is this a problem? Do I need to go to a doctor? Is this terminal? Is this something that's long-term that I'm going to die from? Or, you know, we have thoughts. Or we also may bring up memories. Oh my goodness, this is that injury from that accident. And I can't believe that accident happened. And maybe we have a whole story that goes with that. So we have thoughts that for a pain, we have these two different elements, physical experiences and mental events. And somehow splitting pain into these two parts can help it be a little bit more manageable. Instead of having this black box, this label, pain, it can turn into a stabbing sensation that reminds me of that time 10 years ago. And then we can work with it a little bit easier. We can relax a little bit, that we can choose whichever one is most accessible for us, whichever is easier. We can look at the sensations in the body. Or we can look at our mental thoughts, like maybe they have a quality of being repetitious and going around and around and fast. Or maybe they're feeling really slippery. We can't quite focus at all because we're feeling pain. Or maybe we could look at a sensation in the body and just notice, oh, is it in the exact same spot or is it moving a little bit? Is the intensity exactly the same or is it shifting a little bit? Is it going from heat and stabbing to heat and throbbing or something like this, right? And in this way, kind of like teasing apart and separating, we can stay, it's easier to stay with the actual experience of what's happening, as opposed to getting lost into the concept of pain or getting lost into this idea. So that's one way, that's like an obvious way in which we can work with suffering, which can help ease this idea of me, myself, right? The kind of, there's a tightening that happens when we're in a lot of suffering. It's a natural thing. We all do it, right? There's a little type of lumping, right? That all kind of humans, we have this experience that when we're in pain, we're less able to see others and care about others. Another way is about fear. Often when we are in fear, we're not, it's kind of goes round and round. Maybe we have fear because we've slipped into an us and them type of thinking, and maybe we're afraid of them. Or if we have an us and them type of thinking, fear is more likely to arise. It goes both ways, and we can work with either one, either end of that spectrum. We don't have to choose. There isn't one right way. We can work with whatever is accessible for us, whatever is easiest, whatever is available for us. So working with fear, again, we can do this kind of splitting, do this idea, how is it in the body and how is it in the mind? Fear in the body sometimes can be a tightness in the stomach or a lump in the throat. Maybe it could be a shallowness of breath. Kind of depends on the magnitude of our fear, right? Or kind of the magnitude of our physical experiences. But we could also look at our experience in the mind. And if we do, we will often see that fear is an imagination about the future. It's maybe the, this is an extreme example, but maybe the tiger right there isn't actually, we're afraid that it's what it's about to do, not what it is doing right there, right? That's an extreme example. But fear is very often, not always, but very often kind of an imagination about the future. And we can look at our thoughts and see how, what are we imagining that's kind of supporting this fear or that's making us be fearful? And we can also imagine, or we can also examine, what beliefs do we have that are supporting that thought about the future that is causing this fear, this idea of fear. So looking into what's causing our fear is a way, if we can have less fear, right, is a way, of course, that we can kind of relax this idea of us and them and see how we can then care about others and have compassion for others. Another way is to look at our anger. Often anger, just like fear, either arises from something, somebody out there. Sometimes it's about ourselves here too, but maybe in that way it can be like a certain aspect of ourselves. There's a certain type of splitting that often happens when we have anger. So if we want to kind of support more of the seeing the common humanity, we could look at our anger. And there's a number of ways we can do this as well. Some are to examine, what is it that we are angry at exactly? What is it? If it's a person and we want to be less angry, we can consider this individual has characteristics other than the one that makes me angry, right? They are a complete package. We may not know them. We may not know their whole story, but we can imagine that, we can just imagine, maybe they go home and they are very loving to their dog, right? We can imagine that they pay their bills on time, stop at red lights, and, you know, abide some of these things as social conventions that we have here. We can imagine that even though they may speak harshly to us, they may speak lovingly and kindly to their children or their partner or somebody. Right? So we can, instead of kind of using this label of, oh, this is a difficult person, it's an angry person, or this is a bad person, we can round them out a little bit and imagine, we may not know, we can imagine that there's more to them than just what we're seeing. We don't have to split off just that one little part that we don't like and think that's all that they are. All of us are complex. All of us have so many different aspects to ourselves. So that's one way we can work with anger, is to look at the object. Of course, we can look at our experience of anger as well. And we can, there's this a saying in the suttas that I really like. I don't know the exact wording, but it's something about the idea that being angry at somebody is like wishing to harm them and then picking up a glass of poison and drinking it. Right? That anger has this quality of really being, well, it may sometimes feel energizing. If we really examine it, it's also taxing. And it obstructs our wisdom, our wisest selves, the wisest version of ourselves is not available to us in the midst of our anger. How many times have we said things that we've regretted or done things that we've regretted in the midst of anger? So anger is very powerful, and it can be very useful. It can be an indicator to us, like, oh, there's an injustice here. There is something wrong here. There is something that's not right. Anger has value. But if we are acting out of anger, if we are fueling our anger, if we are cultivating our anger, that, I think, is we're doing ourselves a disservice. because it does have a taxing quality. It not only does it not allow us to be as wise as we could be, but it also has this idea of, like, it kind of makes it constricted. If you think back on times when you've been angry, there's a sense, like, this kind of, like, self-righteousness, you know, like, I've been wronged, and that thing out there is wrong, and there's me here, and that out there, and it really emphasizes that feeling. As opposed to, can we get to this idea of seeing, oh, what's harmful for me, for this person, and for both of us? Can we see the bigger picture of what's where we're all included in this, instead of kind of emphasizing the separation between us? In the Visuddhimagga, which is a text written quite some time after the time of the Buddha, but some Buddhists hold it as very authoritative, and there's some real gems in there, and some of them are how to work with anger. And what I find is interesting is that this whole kind of like lengthy discourse on how to work with anger is given in the context of trying to teach people how to be kind and how to be loving, how to do loving kindness. And it's, you know, the texts say, well, you know, be loving, have loving kindness, be kind. And if you can't, here's how to work with your resentment or how your anger. So it's often anger obstructs our caring for others, you know, being present for others. And some of the things that in this text it talks about to consider, not only kind of the round out the person that they are more than just that aspect you think that they are, but also what is it exactly that you're angry about? Is it their arm? Is it their leg? Is it their body? Is it their hair? Is it their fingers? Is it their mouth? Is it their feet? You know, like, we're a collection of things, and to examine, what is there something in particular? Is it their mental state? Is it what they say? And if you really start to go through this long list of what makes up a human being, you'd see that it's not them as a person. It's not, because there's not a real them there, right? We're all a collection of things. So we could split a person into, oh yeah, they're a collection of parts. And these parts, some of them are body parts, some of them are mental events, some of them are things that they say, some of them are things that they do. That's what kind of makes up a person, right? Is this whole collection. There isn't a essential self there we could be angry at. And so when we start to split things up in this way, some of our anger can dissipate. But some of it, we can start to feel a little bit more spacious about it. Something else that we can do, if we find that we're angry with an individual, rather than breaking them up into parts or seeing, imagining different aspects of them, is also to imagine them as children. Imagine them as infants who can't speak yet and who are dependent on you know, love and care of others. I was at my friend's house yesterday, and you know how at this time of year a lot of people send holiday cards, and now a lot of people send holiday cards that are like pictures, right, of the family, you know, holiday greetings, Merry Christmas, season's greetings, whatever it is. And she had on her refrigerator this picture of the cutest baby, right? I don't know who this baby was, but just seeing this baby, like, oh, look at this, it's so sweet, you know, on her refrigerator. Every single person on this planet at one time was a baby like that. In some ways, we could do a little bit of lumping. We all have, ourselves have been babies, but everybody has been a baby. And maybe if it's difficult to imagine a person that we're angry with, that they're if difficult to imagine them in different aspects or imagine them as different parts, maybe we can imagine them at a different time, when they were young. Because just like us, they didn't get to have control over their environmental conditions when they were very young. They didn't get to control the type of parenting they had. They didn't get to control the culture in which they grew up in. They didn't get to control the location they grew up in, just like us. We didn't either, right? So that's something then which we can consider about others. And I'm saying this as a way to kind of support us to not have so much anger, which can help us, if we don't have anger with an individual, it can help us not have anger in general too. We can practice, so here's a little bit of lumping, right? So that it's anger is anger. It has different magnitudes, and it has we have it against different people. But whenever we're angry, it makes it a little bit easier to be angry again, right? We create these habits in our minds. We make it a little bit, yeah. So we can work with anger with an individual to support us in having less anger in general. If we have less anger in general, that can also support us in not doing this us and them splitting of people, which makes it more difficult to be angry about them, which also makes it easier for us to care about others and to have compassion, to have loving kindness, have friendliness towards others. So getting back to this idea of that's in the Visuddhimagga, this teaching about how to work with one's anger. It goes through a list of a number of things. But in the last one, I think it even says something like, if all else fails, like if all these different things that you've been trying and you find yourself still angry, and I admit I have been here when I've had to do and all else fails, it says, give them a gift. Give a person a gift. This works, I can tell you. So I felt like I was angry with somebody, you know, and it was hard to let go of. It was really, I could see I felt really injured. I felt hurt. I felt betrayed. I couldn't kind of let go of the sense of how could this person do this. And my thoughts, I could see, had kind of a obsessive quality to them. It's kind of going around and around. How could this person do this? And my pain, my injury about it, you know, I felt like such a, when I was during meditation, I could feel like just the heat associated with the anger, you know, kind of the flushed quality of it. And I remembered this teaching. I was flailing around trying to do whatever I could. And then when I started to think about, okay, I'm going to try this gift idea, things started to calm down. Would this person like cookies? Should I bake cookies? I'd love to bake cookies. Maybe I could do something that's, you know, fun for me, bake cookies, and imagine giving them to them. I don't, you know, it's an everything whether you actually do, right? All of us can make this decision for ourselves, whether that makes sense. But just that shift away from how could this person do this to what would they like? What can I do that can support them? Because just like me, they want to be free from suffering too. And then this brings me to this last idea. That is, if we want to work with all the ways in which we tend to kind of split people into us and them, which then leads to problems and it can obstruct our greatest wisdom, we can also do the opposite. We can cultivate those things that help us see how we're similar. We can cultivate those things that help us see the common humanity, how we are the same. And there's something that I learned about when I was doing compassion cultivation training. This is down at Stanford, this compassion training. It's an 8-week course. It's based on a Buddhist text, but it's a secular training. And they have this, and I should say it's also based on all these scientific studies too about, you know, how to increase cultivation, compassion, and how can we help people have what they call pro-social behavior, right? To really make it so that people are kind towards one another and generous towards one another. And this idea of promoting a common humanity is one of the key aspects. And they've done these scientific studies of here's a way. Very simple. This isn't in the Buddhist teachings, but if I were the Buddha, I would put it in the teachings. To imagine, I wonder what kind of vegetables this person likes. It's very simple. There's something about it, right? It doesn't require sophisticated thinking. But if you all of a sudden start to wonder, does she like Brussels sprouts? It kind of helps normalize, takes the heat out of things, takes the kind of humanizes them, right? Instead of into a them or into that person, which I'm angry. It's like, oh, they're a person just like me. They eat vegetables just like me. Or as the case may be, sometimes they don't eat vegetables just like me. So is there a way in that we can bring to mind in which ways we are similar to help us support this idea of can we lump people together so that we can treat them with kindness and compassion, decrease suffering, without diminishing or discounting or dismissing our differences? We all have beautiful things to offer and to celebrate, but we all also have things to share. So in this way, kind of the Buddhist teachings are, can we split apart some of our experiences rather than pain? Can it be sensations in the body and mental events? Rather than anger, can we make the person round them out and make them see the, how we are? And can we take care of our own suffering too, so that we are more able to do these types of things, to do the, to see the fear and to see the anger? And also to see how we get triggered. If we, the better we understand our own suffering, we can see how we get triggered by objects out there, or how we have an idea we want to fix these things here as opposed to allow them to be, or change that person there. Can we kind of take care of ourselves so that we can have a little bit more ease, so that we have a little bit more capacity to see how we're the same? So in this way, I kind of wanted to lump together some of these Buddhist teachings about how so many of the teachings are about splitting some things but lumping other things together in a way that helps us be compassionate and caring for all of us, for everybody. And I wish for you all, may you all, everybody in this room, we all share this humanity, may you all have ease and well-being, some peace and some happiness on this beautiful rainy day. Thank you.